It's the Wonky Show. The party leaders have spoken out on student maintenance. We'll discuss what they had to say. The OIA has posted up some post-grant complaints. We'll survey the wreckage. And did we grow international too quickly? It's all coming up.
Helping people understand how different it is. You're not going to get the summer. You're going to do your dissertation. You're going to get assessments coming thick and fast. Your student finance system is like designed to trick you.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here, fully costed and fully funded, as ever, three fantastic guests. In Uckfield, Michelle Morgan is Dean of Students at the University of East London. Michelle, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, gosh, I've had COVID, so the highlight of my week was getting a negative test.
Well, how extraordinary. You know those tests don't really work anymore on the news, right? in Sheffield, Mark Bennett is Director of Audience and Insight at Finder University. Mark, your highlight of the week, please.
I'm kind of undecided. It's either seeing Placebo live in Halifax or seeing my son live at his school playing cornet. I'll go with the son.
Yeah. School plays sell out. And in Frome in Somerset, Michael Salmon is News Editor at Wonky. Michael, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, at the time of recording, it's 1 week to the general election, and I'm both very keen for the actual day and, you know, staying up all night watching the results come in. And I'm also really, really pleased the campaign is almost over because I'm really sick of it.
Yes, aren't we? We'll start this week with maintenance. Money-saving expert Martin Lewis has been grilling the party leaders on student finance. Michael, what did they have to say?
Yeah, so this was quite interesting because student maintenance has just been nowhere in the election campaign, as we've been talking about. I mean, obviously, HE as a whole sector has not figured enormously, but, you know, there's been the odd sort of interesting comment about what Labour might do sort of to stabilise the sector or possible post-16 review at some point. But yeah, student maintenance, student finance, cost of living crunch that students have faced over the last many years now, just as we know where. So really, really good to see Martin Lewis actually get some answers. He's this guy from moneysavingexpert.com, most trusted man
former,
in Britain.
Former London School of Economics Students Union General Secretary, of course, as well.
Of course, yes. Let's not forget that. So he's done this thing before where he sort of organises what he calls a leaders' debate on consumer issues, which is obviously his bag. And one of the questions that he sent out to all the parties was about student finance, you know, making the point that students have really struggled with living costs, maintenance has been nowhere near keeping up with, you know, the level it should be, inflation and, you know, the actual real expenses. And he asked them what they'd do. I mean, so, and it wasn't a spoken debate. It was up on his website, and all the parties sent in statements. For some of them, it was more or less what they've said in the manifestos. The Conservative statement kind of defended just basically what it's done very poorly in office. But Labour's answer was actually quite interesting for a couple of reasons. So one thing, we had this line from Keir Starmer saying that the party wants to take the time to get this right, this question of maintenance and students, you know, the finance available to them. And they said it don't want to deliver more bungled reforms, you know, probably with an eye to sort of Plan 5 and things like that in England. And it said that the party would work through the modelling with students and universities, i.e. kind of slowly, which is not sort of breaking news, but it's interesting to hear at least a little bit of the thinking there. I thought the other thing was interesting was that he began his answer by talking about, you know, immediate policy from Labour on things like the national minimum wage and on the cost of accommodation, and sort of really pinpointing those things as areas where the party will do work that will benefit students. So it's kind of interesting to see Labour tying together, you know, work and housing with students, even if, you know, we can sort of get into the details of why there's not going to be any radical changes here. But it's, you know, it's interesting that they're thinking beyond just what are maintenance levels.
Mark, I think Michael's, I mean, it is the end. Michael has introduced the item, but I think it's probably fair to say that Michael sounds a little bit more impressed than I did when I read about this on the side.
I'll be honest. My favorite bit in your piece was probably the analysis of reform, where I think you noted that their promise is to abolish the interest rates, which is something that the Tories have already done. So I'd like to get that in, but I don't know. I may not help you, Jim, because I'm also broadly positive. So I quite like the fact that there's this talk of removing age bans for minimum wage, considering cost of living, because what it means, of course, is that they're going to ground this in some version of economic reality. I know it's not necessarily going to be fixing the root problem, which is the farcical way in which, you know, the amounts and thresholds for the maintenance loan are calculated, but at least there is this sense that you have to link this stuff to what things actually cost. And again, you know, I'm one of these people. I had a bit of a back and forth on LinkedIn about this actually with some people in the sector. You know, the manifesto doesn't commit Labour to doing anything at all. I agree, but it does at least, if they're elected on it, it provides a mandate for as much reform as they want to do. And I guess, I don't know, I'm broadly positive about it, but let's see.
Michelle, I mean, obviously, you know, we're assuming there's going to be a Labour government. But if you know, if you don't live in rented accommodation, and you know, you're already on the adult minimum wage, this does nothing, does it?
It doesn't. And I have to say that I haven't read anything in any of the manifestos that gives me hope that the current situation is actually going to change or improve for our students, especially for those in England. And for me, there are a number of continuing challenges that are just not being properly spoken about. The first is, if maintenance loans do go up, it will increase the total debt for students. And we know this is going to impact on students from disadvantaged backgrounds more than those from advantaged. And the second, and importantly, is looking down the pipeline. If fees and maintenance loans increase, the expected debt levels of studying at university will put off potential applicants from disadvantaged backgrounds. And students in schools are talked to about university and what it entails. But what outreach and marketing departments in universities may not be aware of, so not necessarily effectively addressing it when they go in, is that in January of 2023, the provider access legislation for schools and FE introduced mandatory training in schools, optional for further education, for all students across a range of ages to have at least 6 encounters with approved providers of apprenticeships and technical education. And the rationale was to help learners understand and have the opportunity to take up not just apprenticeships, but wider technical education, such as T-levels and higher technical qualifications. And having spoken to a couple of careers advisors in poor areas of Brighton, they have anecdotally said that they are already seeing students from disadvantaged backgrounds just not considering university as an option. And although we have a population under 18 growing up until 2030, we may well see a decline in applications amongst 18 and 19 year olds, as we have seen those in the 21 to 24 category in the UCAS figures.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree, Michelle, with this point about sort of debt and the, you know, the downsides to increasing maintenance loans. I mean, this may be just way too much overanalysis of what was a short statement from Labour, when someone sort of held a gun to their head and said, "Tell us something about student finance." But, you know, it did seem to me, it sort of suggests a bit like the lobbying from the sector around increase student maintenance, bring back student maintenance grants, which we've seen in lots of sort of mission groups and lots of sector manifestos, is probably not, you know, potentially is not really going to cut through to Labour. I mean, at some point they may do a wider review but it's certainly not going to immediately cut through. And they are going to be, put it like this, there'll be a need for the sector to come up with some policy ideas which are not just, you know, use debt, use the loan book to improve students' lot. And that could be in areas like sort of work or housing or food or other things.
Here's a question, Michael, right? You know, there's basically a food bank in every university at this point. And, you know, there wasn't a couple of 3 years ago. And that has not cut through into the agenda. Now, I kind of posted up on Twitter the other day, 3 theories about why this might be. So one is the party that actually doesn't understand the extent of the problem. It just doesn't understand the problem. Second is, if they bang on about students, it sounds all Corbynish. And third is, it's kind of embarrassing to have a plan to tackle student poverty when you don't have much of a plan to tackle poverty in general. I mean, what's your sense of why? But and have you got a fourth theory?
Yeah, well, I think there are some others. I did see you put that poll up, but I never actually asked you what people said. So maybe at the end you can share what was the winner. I mean, obviously, there's the other issue is that students are not seen as an important target voter, right? They're sort of traditionally been seen as a sort of, yeah, well, partly they're in the bag or they're not, you know, at least traditionally they've not been in the marginals. That, you know, their turnout rate of just sort of young, you know, the younger age group generally has not been that good, although, you know, for students I think it's traditionally been sort of fairly you know, it's been okay. I do think it'll also be interesting to see whether, you know, if 16 and 17 year olds get the, you know, the voter franchise extended to them, whether these questions do get a bit more salience in future campaigns. I think it'd be sort of interesting to think about. I mean, I don't really know. I think it is probably an issue, a mix of all of these things. But in particular, it's just, it's not something that maybe sells well in how Labour are trying to position themselves right in the centre, or sort of, you know, stealing the Tories' lunch a little bit in terms of sort of talking tough on restraint and sort of, you know, I don't know. It's depressing, isn't it? What do people say on Twitter?
Well, 45.5% said they don't realise the extent. And the reason I think that is wishful thinking is if you count the number of backbench MPs that have raised questions in Parliament about, you know, backbench Labour MPs, about questions in Parliament about student hardship, it's basically a hell of a lot of them. And what the government has done each time is then kind of waggle the magic money twig. Now, you know, if folk on Twitter are thinking, oh, they just don't get it, and as soon as they get it, they'll fix it. I'm not so sure, folks. But then maybe I've just reached this point, the point in the election campaign where I'm beyond even my usual levels of cynicism. I guess the other question mark is, when people have talked about students during the election, as usual, they're talking about 18 to 21-year-old undergraduates away from home. You know, they're talking about Keir Starmer's childhood. Is that just inevitable?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, we're going to come on to postgrad, aren't we, and the fact that actually there are, you know, there's a far wider range of student experiences out there that we need to be thinking about. And I suppose that applies to undergraduate too, you know. Our kind of data of focus and expertise is mostly PG, but in that audience, domestic, we're seeing lots of people obviously don't want to study away from home in that traditional, you know, dormitory kind of style because it's too expensive. And actually, you know, when you look at older students, it obviously has an impact on other responsibilities, whether that's work or childcare. So I think that, yeah, I think there is a limitation there, and I think that's true generally. One of the things I think when we do hear, I was just listening to you guys chatting, one of the things that occurs to me when we do hear Starmer talking about this, and he has a couple of times, hasn't he, on some of the, whether it was Question Time or one of the other debate platforms, you know, he's very keen, isn't he, to kind of almost play it off against the NHS. So he says explicitly, I have considered this Corbyn-era policy to abolish fees, etc., you know, fix the funding. However, I can only afford to do one or the other. So I think when we talk about the student vote, I think he's obviously trying to appeal to a much broader vote because everyone uses the NHS. So I don't know how much that's a kind of factor here.
I was going to ask you, Michelle. Michelle, I mean, I guess one of the good things that is in there, and they've kind of, you know, they've had to kind of plunder another policy area to kind of prop up the answer, but we're going to get this move, aren't we, from a minimum wage that is based on a remit for the Loan Pay Commission that is about, you know, some, you know, kind of being above the average, you know, looking at kind of average pay and trying to grow, to the living wage methodology, which is about the amount of money that people need to get by. And I guess, you know, both for universities and for student unions, as usual, that is a great piece of news if you're working in a bar, but, you know, there will be a significant uplift on, you know, the minimum wage in theory throughout the year. And of course, they're not going to compensate universities and student unions in order to pay it.
Yeah, I think the major problem, Jim, that you've got is that, you know, students are working in things like coffee shops, student unions, which actually appeal to or provide services for students. But if students don't have the money, they cannot actually engage and buy those items.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of this, you know, I'll always say this, won't I, Michael? You know, as much of this problem with student cost of living is about, you know, giving students enough to live on, either through loans or grants or, you know, part-time work or whatever. But it is also about their costs. And, you know, certainly one of the things I'm picking up anecdotally is a lot of the sort of cost of living crisis era costs things, you know, free breakfast clubs and, you know, cheaper lunches on a Tuesday are all being wound down as the sector faces a kind of wider cost of living, wider financial crisis.
I think that's right. And that's sort of what I was trying to get at before, saying I think there's a need for the sector to come up with policies that aren't just bring up maintenance levels, there also need to be some policies around, you know, this is some things the government could do that would, or some things that we could do, you know, if allowed to, or, you know, about how we can get students' costs down and how we can sort of minimize the, you know, because students are, essentially are just a group that's very vulnerable, maybe almost, you know, more than many, many others to big inflationary increases of the kind we've had in the last few years around in areas like sort of food, energy, and sort of the, you know, the cheaper and less well sort of maintained area, the rental market. You know, so that's why I'm always a little bit sort of leery of, you know, the conversation around, okay, if we just pump money into maintenance loans, that will have a big effect on students. I mean, it will, for one thing, it will drive costs up. It will drive prices up and rents up.
Yes, this is Sunday Financial Pointer, isn't it? You know, landlords like most of that if students are living in rented accommodation. Mark, just before we come off this, for PGRs, as I remember, UKRI are in the middle of or still doing or drawing out a piece of work on how much the kind of standard stipend should be. I don't know where, I have no sense of where that project's got to, you?
No, I mean, I'm trying to remember what the process was. So obviously it was uprated significantly during the pandemic, quite rightly. And then they kind of had to slow it down, didn't they? Had to slow down the rates. And I think it's ended up higher than where it would have been, but still not perhaps as high as it should be. And of course, you know, with PGR, the problem is the budget it comes out of is generally fixed, isn't it? So you can give bigger slices of pie, but then you have less slices. So that is a whole other thing, I think, yes.
In an era where lots of people are being made redundant in the sector, and presumably some providers are hoping that PGRs can fill in some of the teaching gaps.
The thing that worries me is that universities are having to cut back what they deliver and how they deliver it because of the financial situation. Many institutions are having to make redundancies. And so there's potentially less money in the pot to be able to do, as you say, those breakfast clubs, those support requirements. And, you know, we're all in the process of completing or having submitted already our APP plans, you know, and that is critical to build in to demonstrate how we can actually support our students with that cost of living issue in helping disadvantaged students engage and succeed.
And actually, Michael, just before we come off this, I mean, that's a real puzzle, isn't it, for the Office for Students? Because on the one hand, it's publishing documents that demonstrate that, you know, a shed ton of providers are about to be in deficit. On the other hand, it hasn't changed or updated or said anything, you know, about this in the context of those APP expectations. I guess, you know, the OFS's line would be, well, if the plan's credible, the plan's credible. But how do you assess credibility in these circumstances?
Yeah, it brings us back to this old sort of, you know, divorce between what we think about sort of student support and helping students and the sort of access and participation work, and then on the other side, the sort of the attention to the sector's finances, but also just sort of regulation more broadly, that it's just, you know, looking at sort of, you know, inspecting the work universities are doing and sort of passing judgment on it. That it still does feel, and you know, all these things around the cost of living, but also, you know, around an incoming government, does feel like that circle's never really been, still hasn't really been squared, and there's sort of still work to be done. I mean, this will be interesting to see how Labour's, you know, talking points about a sort of regulatory reset and a kind of rethink about regulation, if it can actually sort of pay some attention to this question of, you know, is the regulator there to, you know, look at the quality of experience that students are having? Is it there to keep an eye on how universities are doing, and how do you cross the bridge between those two things when sometimes they're at odds?
Yeah. Well, fascinating stuff. And certainly, you know, once Parliament's back up and running, it will be fascinating to see whoever ends up as the HE minister, what their answer will be, other than blaming, you know, the predecessors on when someone raises student cost of living. Anyway, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name's Mike Gray from Grad Consult, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about how universities are a catalyst for economic development and will have a critical role in supporting economies to recover and grow. We know that with a new government, there could be new opportunities, and that Career servers in particular have a pivotal role with it in terms of external engagement. We know that they're often the door in for many, many businesses to engage with an institution, and there's a real opportunity to innovate in this space. This may involve experimenting with new delivery models, developing more holistic student success teams, investing in different technology solutions, or adopting alternative strategies to better engage students, academics, and employers. It's a time for bold action to future-proof provision, and lots of exciting developments in the space.
Now, next up this week, the Office for the Independent Adjudicator has published some of the issues it sees in complaints from postgrads, Mark.
Yes, that's true. Perhaps unsurprisingly, PG hasn't really made it into any of the manifestos for the election. There is something on LLE in the Conservative manifesto, but I don't think we should count that. And there's also a little bit on research in Labour. But I'm sure we all agree, Michelle and I certainly will, that it's something a government should think more about post-election, and we'll hopefully get on to that. But as you say, in the meantime, we've had some interesting insight into the PG student experience, how much it differs from undergraduate, and what happens when it appears to go wrong. So the Office for the Independent Adjudicator has picked out some themes in the issues it sees in complaints from PG students, and a few examples. It notes that PG is actually overrepresented in the complaints it receives, and that within that set, they're mostly international, which I think makes sense. International obviously account for a large proportion of PG. I'd say, actually, having looked through it as well, that PGR seem to be, very, very heavily represented. Seems the PGT complaints cover similar ground to undergraduate students, and they're dealt with using the same processes. So the particular challenge, as we can think about this, it concerns the brevity of most master's programs. It's very, very difficult for universities or students to make changes in time for them to be impactful. The way the OIA puts this is, if things go wrong, opportunities to put things right at a later point in studies can be more limited. That short length, of course, also means students have to process an awful lot of information very quickly. The OIA also notes, a need, therefore, to make those expectations clearer for students. So for PGT, it's around academic conduct. There are a lot of, cases to do with that and assessment. For PGR, it's mainly about supervision, which kind of is, your formative assessment during a PhD. And as I say, PGR is very heavily represented in the case summaries. And, I think a lot of these kind of gesture towards the slightly oblique and obscure status of PhD students. There are complaints relating to students being denied progression or award of a degree. And there's also, as the OIA notes, a general lack of clarity. This comes back to some of what we've been talking about with students working, actually, a lack of clarity around some PhDs, of course, being both students and employees as teaching assistants. So altogether, I think it's a really interesting window onto some of the problems with PG that don't get spoken about enough.
I mean, it's a fascinating set of case studies. I mean, one of the bits that's in the case studies, and both in the policy note, Mike, is a student whose supervisor sort of accepts VR, tells them they're accepting VR, and then the student doesn't find out who their actual supervisor is going to be for 4 months. Now, maybe 4 months is a bit of a kind of extreme case, but that must be happening to a lot of people right now.
Yeah, in all kinds of ways, and even not just, the voluntary redundancy aspect of it is, this sort of thing happens all the time, and just from my anecdotal experience, it's not really something that universities are really sort of springing into action to sort about when somebody, ends a supervisory relationship, someone moves to another university, or in this case, accepts voluntary redundancy, that how do you appoint a supervisor? That question is actually quite difficult. You need to find someone with the right research interests, who's got the time and the capacity to actually sort of go back over some of the ground that's already been there. There's a whole sort of how do you model that into workloads question. It's very difficult. And it really just, reading these case studies, you really sort of think, okay, the postgraduate research questions we've got here are very quite divorced from the kind of issues that postgraduate taught students are facing from. It really is quite separate. And I mean, OIA says this, they're not trying to say, oh, all postgrads are the same. But, it did sort of strike to me there's quite a growing division between what postgraduate taught means and what postgraduate research means. They are increasingly not at all the same thing.
I'll tell you what I was thinking this morning, Michelle. So, you know, obviously, and DK will talk about this in a few minutes, but, you know, there's a new, you know, QAA have published the new quality code today, and it says what it says, and you've got the quality code. Then you've got the kind of B conditions for universities in England. And actually, when you boil off the sort of learning in the casework note here, and you view it from the point of view of what rights the postgrads have, this is infinitely more helpful for postgraduate students than either of those other two quality documents. And it seems to me, you know, it's a bit messy, this environment, in terms of being clear with students what they should be getting, what they should be entitled to, and how to raise things if they're not getting it.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, Mark and I are on the same page on this. For so long, the postgraduate taught area has been neglected. And so actually having, you know, more support, more detail is very helpful. And it is really challenging because postgraduate courses really, really do differ in size, depending on discipline. And I think the other thing that is really, really important is the UK domiciled market is quite different from the overseas market of students coming in. Overseas students in EU primarily study full-time masters. UK domiciled, it's much more complicated in that just over half of the student body undertaking postgraduate taught are taking master's courses, about 57%, I think it is. The rest are doing PG certs, diplomas, and other postgraduate courses. And yet we have this overriding umbrella that just basically one size fits all. And I think we have to be much more nuanced in managing student expectations and laying out requirements of different levels of study at postgraduate level.
Michael, I mean, obviously, over time, the sector has built up a set of kind of traditions here about complaints handling, hasn't it? You know, in terms of kind of pace, you normally make a complaint, and then, you know, if that is not upheld, there's an appeal, and then you can get to the OIA. And if you add all that up on average, there's no way an international student on one of your master's programme is ever going to be able to get through that complaint process to have their complaint resolved, is there?
It does seem, for me, from the outside, it does seem like really hard to understand how this works, you know, in terms of, so these complaints are being resolved a long time after these courses are finished. The students will not be in the country anymore, almost certainly. You know, there's just a few sort of determined, dogged students who are like, okay, I'm going to pursue this. I'm not just going to go, ah.
It's not like UKVI get a note from the OIA and go, okay, no, you can stay for a while, is it?
Yeah, well, exactly that. But also just, you know, not even about the visa thing and where you are, but I just feel like, you know, for postgraduate tour students, when they've finished their course in, you know, perhaps in a very, you know, in some cases, a very negative sort of final bitter taste in the mouth at the end. They've moved on, they're at work, they're in probably in another country in many cases. And, you know, just to have the determination to actually stick with, I'm going to make a complaint and I'm going to see it through to the end. I'm not just going to sort of, you know, stop replying to the emails and just let it go and just say, okay, come on, I'm moving on with my life. You know, we must be looking at quite a small subset of very determined students who are, you know, really got a sort of bit between their teeth to take it all the way through to the end. I mean, obviously these like case summaries that we get are very interesting and are certainly not, we couldn't make the case they're a representative sample of, you know, the postgraduate taught student experience. And we don't really know what that's like beyond a couple of sort of, you know, not hugely well completed surveys. But I did really think reading them that for the postgraduate taught ones, it kind of paints a picture of what we sort of know is the case elsewhere in other parts from other data sources of sort of international students in a kind of hot house trying to really power their way through programs while juggling visa problems leading to like late starts, working at the same time. It really does just the sense you get of reading them is just sort of time pressure and trying to cram more into much less than 12 months, right? When you consider when you actually get started and when you actually finish. And it sort of was kind of stressful to read.
So here's a question, Mark. Okay, here's a question. You work in kind of recruitment, choosing universities, you know, postgrads and so on. Mm-hmm. The UK is not common in offering one-year masters, right? That's one of the selling points. So if it's the case that the UK has managed to speed up the process of getting a master's, should it be the case that the UK commits to speeding up the process of resolving complaints?
Yes, I think so. Yes, it would be interesting to see how that compares. I mean, it's odd, isn't it? I think, you know, we were talking, weren't we, about student expectations. Obviously, you know, this is something we spend a lot of time working on. Part of our role is to provide advice and guidance. And, you know, to understand what this, not current students, not the kind of rear view mirror, if you like, but the prospective students, you know, the ones coming down the road. And there's interesting stuff in there. But actually, like, I don't think they do understand. I certainly didn't. You know, I've done the whole shebang up to PhD and so on. And I think the year, my master's year, was by far the most intense and stressful. You know, that it's a real 12 months. They're not used to that. I think my biggest thing with PG is, and I'm sure Michelle will agree with this when I go into the finance in a sec, you know, is the deceptive similarity to UG. We are not helping people understand how different it is. You're not going to get the summer. You're going to do your dissertation. You're going to get assessments coming thick and fast. Your student finance system is like designed to trick you. Okay,
and if you're from another country in a different educational system and tradition,
I say it's intense. I didn't even have the visa stuff to contend with. But you know, undergrads, they get a student loan. That whatever we think of that system, right? It covers their full fee. It pays it for them. They get some sort of entitlement to a means-tested maintenance component. We talked about that, right? None of this is true for postgraduates funded by SFE. You get a loan amount that seems absolutely arbitrary. It's just a bizarre number. You know, there's no link to a fee. It's not the cost of a master's. The student still has to pay that fee themselves, which they've probably never done before. They've never had to manage payment schedules, and there's no maintenance component. And the fees vary. It's crazy. You know, that's before we get onto all the bits of the sector, as Michelle quite rightly says, that it completely misses, which to me seems mad at the moment when we're talking about upskilling, reskilling, etc.
Regarding the international students, I think the thing that we are incredibly poor at doing is bridging the experience from their educational system into the UK at master's, and we're very poor. So many expectations are set by the people within the country who actually organise the places. And so this is the problem. It's about bridging the expectations and making sure that actually they come in and instead of having to hit the ground running, they've done the pre-work of understanding how the UK education system works at postgraduate level, what's expected. And so actually it's not a shock to them. And I think this is the problem as I talk to colleagues around the sector, especially with the huge increase in Indian students in the last 2 to 3 years, is the shock of the students about how different the education system is.
The OIA touches on that, doesn't it? Actually, because they note, don't they, that there are some situations where I think it's visa delays means students miss that part of the course when it is available.
I mean, university is saying you're fine to enrol 4 weeks after the course has started, miss all the induction. And then, you know, people, you know, kind of then miss all the essential stuff about, you know, being able to kind of do well and so on. Here's a question, Michael, okay? If you work at the OIA, and this is reflected in some of these cases that are in the note, if you work at the OIA, you must be used to coming into work and thinking, one of the things I'm going to look at today is an academic appeal where the provider has applied academic judgment and the student is complaining about, you know, poor supervision or poor induction or whatever, and it's kind of too late. And that appeal is likely to fail. I reckon to fix that, what you do is 3 or 4 weeks into a program, you test every student on their understanding of extenuating circumstances policies and how to switch to supervisor policies and so on. And if they fail it, you don't let them carry on. What do you think?
I mean, certainly, I think as a sort of, you know, you need to be putting in place strategies to make sure students understand the sort of processes that apply to them. I mean, you know, in some of these cases that we've got, it's quite clear that students don't really, especially when it comes to this sort of academic judgment side of things, where we sort of have students essentially just trying to appeal through the OIA that they didn't get the award they sort of had invested years of their life in, and an awful lot of money in, and the OIA sort of rightly, as the guidelines are written up, saying, you know, this was assessed by a panel of experts in the case of, you know, visas and things that, and this isn't something we would rule on. But it is tough, especially as people have said, this issue around how little time there is to do these things.
I'm Adam Matthews, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Birmingham. Debbie McVitie and I are continuing our analysis of general election manifesto texts from 1945 to 2019. This week it's the first decade of the 21st century. As we get closer to the 2024 general election, our reviews are getting closer to the present day. which has the advantage that I lived through the decade as a student and a voter, but so too did many Wonky readers and those working in higher education. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of different perspectives on the decade that was dominated by New Labour and Tony Blair. Higher education and universities are not featuring prominently in the debate ahead of the 2024 election, despite being on Sue Gray's infamous list. This was not the case, however, during the first decade of the century. After a post-war consensus on higher education growth, the high watermark of this ambition was New Labour's promise to open higher education to half of young people. The key issue that faced the electorate and Labour MPs was who was to pay: the individual, the state, or, as was the political zeitgeist of the time, a third-way combination of the two. New Labour had a 179-seat majority from 1997 and won the first two general elections of the century. So, they had a mandate which allowed them to follow through with the conclusions of the Deering Report and to ask students to contribute financially to their education. Despite having a 167-seat majority in 2004, the government won a vote on tuition fees, which later became the Higher Education Act 2004, by just 5 votes, and this paved the way for tuition fees and the loan system that we have today. Such was the power of the New Labour machine, both the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats opposed fees throughout the decade to try and regain support from the electorate. You can read more about all of this on the site, along with the largely forgotten Millennium Bug, which was the technological dystopia of the day as programmers held their breath on the format of the date as we entered the new millennium.
Good, now DK has some quality news.
Exciting times in the thrill-a-minute world of UK quality assurance for higher education. A new Quality Council for UKHE will replace the old UK Standing Committee for Quality Assessment, while the Quality Assurance Agency has launched a new version of the sector-owned UK Quality Code. Now stop right there. You were going to fast-forward this, weren't you? Because you don't think this is important. It is important. Listen to me. I will tell you. In recent years, it's been the government and regulators, in particular the Office for Students in England, that have decided what is a poor quality course and what is not, that have decided what is to be taught on undergraduate degrees and what is not to be taught, that has made decisions about assessment. You remember the spelling, punctuation and grammar thing. In the old days, it didn't used to be like this. Academics made these kind of decisions with the support of quality professionals, backed up by a quality assurance process and informed by the thoughts, opinions and feedback of the students that were experiencing this stuff. These changes today are the start of a return to that kind of a model. The new Quality Council has removed funders and regulators from the council itself. They just get to be observers. Instead, it's bringing in academics and students to make these decisions and to support active and independent work on stuff like essay mills, artificial intelligence, international student experience. Meanwhile, the Quality Code explicitly links to international standards, something the Office of Students has been criticised for in Parliament numerous times. It is going to apply to the standards applicable to all tertiary institutions, not just universities. This is something that's happening already in Wales, Scotland, increasingly in Northern Ireland, and England is moving in this direction as well. Unfortunately, regulation has not looked in that way. In both cases, it's bringing back the idea of understanding teaching quality enhancement, understanding what is actually going on in the classroom, rather than looking just at outputs and numbers. It's all, I think you'll agree, pretty exciting stuff. There's a bunch of things on the site that for you to read about, and there'll be lots of chances for you to get involved in the same way that the sector has been involved with the development of the Quality Code all throughout its history. It is exciting times in quality assurance. If you had checked out of this area, I suggest you check back in.
Okay, finally this week, two reports from the Social Market Foundation have warned the sector against dismissing public and policymaker concerns about international students, Michelle.
Indeed, yes. The first one, Crazy for You, argues that the sector's marshalling of advocacy to defend international student recruitment has been formidable and impressive. However, the sector seems uninterested in engaging with any evidence that it has not generated itself, which they argue is a strategy which risks significantly misrepresenting the context of the concerns and tensions in this policy area. The reports look to make policy recommendations for the next government. First and foremost, that total student visa issuance should be capped by UKVI, with an onus on universities obviously being able to demonstrate that suitable accommodation is available when wanting to increase institutional allocations. The think tank made, possibly optimistic, the case that this should be offset by inflation-pegged teaching grants for home students. And there is also a call for the next update to the UK International Education Strategy to contain measurable diversification targets about which countries should be recruited from. So we know the benefits of international students, but because I think of the funding system that we currently have, you know, it's felt that the sectors had no choice but to maximise international participation in order to be financially viable. And for me, it just feels like we're constantly playing catch up and having to react once the students get here, rather than being able to proactively and effectively plan for who will actually turn up and identify the support they need. And because we don't have real joined up data in real time, you know, we have to rely on data such as the HESA returns. You know, we knew, for example, the pattern in growth of international students, especially from India, was all there to see in the HESA returns from 2020 onwards. So my argument is, if we had a mandatory UCAS process at postgraduate level, like we do at undergrad, to capture and share the data on an applicant, which people like me and Paul Wakelin have long argued for, we could identify support requirements and plan for whom we see is coming through, as we know who have put them down as their first and second choice university. When a system was briefly introduced, gosh, I think it was in about 2012, it was voluntary and something like only 13 universities participated. So if there was an independent body such as UCAS processing applications, it may help create more confidence amongst international applicants in declaring key information such as dependents and pregnancy. But I think also importantly, it helps institutions plan. When I asked the Home Office and UKVI for data highlighting if a student came in independently but later applied for a dependent visa, because across the sector has been reported there's an increase in students coming in pregnant or becoming pregnant whilst here. Absolutely. I was told this information does not exist. So if we have this data, joined up data, we can not only plan more effectively, but we are in a position, backed by evidence, to influence policy and government legislation.
Yeah. Now, Mark, Crazy For You is also, of course, the title of a Let Loose single from the 90s. Their follow-up single was called One Night Stand, and their follow-up to that was called Best In Me. Which of the titles do you think applies here?
I had no idea where you were going with that. I'm really not sure how to answer. I'll go with Best. Best In Me seems to be the thing. Can I do my little
album,
slightly...
The album, by the way, was called Rollercoaster. So there
well,
you go.
Well, that
you
know, obviously is the correct answer.
Got to avoid the ups
answer.
And downs of recruitment, haven't we?
Rollercoaster, yes. Look, you know, if I can be... I agree with everything Michelle said. A couple of points I'd make, you know... I think that we do need better data on applications, enrollments, and so on. You know, there is work in a few places that's kind of getting towards that, but it's difficult. But equally, you know, I would be happy for the government to talk to organisations like us. You know, I can tell you who is searching. And obviously that is not an application enrollment. We see huge shifts and we see them pivot in real time with visa policy and stuff. That data does exist with organizations like Fine University, Keystone, who we're part of and so on. So we can help with some of that. It won't tell you everything you need to know, but it's useful. But, you know, if I could be optimistic, so there's this proposal, isn't there, to kind of offset the reduction. So they've identified that the problem is the reliance on the fee. Fine. They're going to offset it by increasing the teaching grant. That feels complex. Maybe someone else wants to talk about that. You know, it doesn't seem so simple to me that you can add in undergraduate subsidy effectively or whatever you want to call it to offset PG, because it will be different sizes and shapes across the sector. But you know what would be nice, if I could be a bit maverick, would be if by fixing the over-reliance on international fees, we could bring them down, because they're astronomic. And actually, we have a situation where international students are, I think, if I could be general, one of two types of person. They're either wealthy enough, and we can pick particular geos this probably represents, they're wealthy enough they don't mind, or they are taking a desperate gamble. They are putting it all on this to get over. And that's in those OIA examples, isn't it? That pressure to succeed. So that might be nice too. Mm.
You know, I think what's important to notice here is that this is a report from the Social Market Foundation, fairly centrist think tank. They're not the sort of like extreme center for policy studies kind of, you know, that sort of side of the political debate. And that what they're clearly saying is that the sector's lobbying and sort of advocacy, let's say, in favor of international students may have sort of made a successful case for the Migration Advisory Committee. But in just in terms of kind of centrist policy making of the kind that, you know, Keir Starmer is likely to bring in, this idea that sort of just, expanding and growing international recruitment and increasing international student numbers is that case has not really been made. And the sector at times, according to them, has sort of seemed a little bit like it's sort of, you know, protesting too much and painting others in the debate as sort of, you know, being racist for commenting on the international student numbers at all. And so I think, it sort of does give a bit of a sense of where this is going to go in terms of the debate in the next government, not in the kind of current one.
Yeah. And Mark, that matters, doesn't it? Because, I was at UKESA conference actually the other day, and one of the things I was saying was, look, if we're about to get a kind of centre-leftish government, well, there's a kind of centre-leftish government in Canada and there's a centre-leftish government in Australia, and they're both in the process of putting caps on.
Yes, well, it is. It's the international game of hold my pint and pour it on my head, isn't it, when it comes to international recruitment? Yeah, it's one of the things, obviously, we speak to a lot of people in marketing and recruitment, and when we try to be slightly reassuring, it's bad elsewhere too. There isn't necessarily, a consensus that this is just I agree, essentially. This isn't simply we have a Tory government, therefore we'll have bad international recruitment policy, if you like. It's not as simple as that. And as the report says, coming back to it, like, I don't wish to be uncharitable to them. I think it's sensible. It identifies the root cause. But just going, oh, well, international's a problem. Well, we'll just fix undergrad then. We'll just fix the, as if you can do that in one stroke. That's the problem, isn't it? That needs to be fixed before international, which is also postgrad, and it's kind of all teetering on that.
And I think the other challenge that we face is that, comment is made through a very small lens, and it's just looking at the UK situation. As you said, Mark, it's not looking at the challenges elsewhere in Australia, in Canada, that are experiencing very similar issues. So it's not just a UK-based challenge. It is a global challenge.
And we do, obviously, we see, and it does exactly as you'd expect, Michelle, in terms of people searching right now, people at that early stage looking for courses. Interest is down in the UK. Interest is also down in Australia and Canada. It's actually up slightly for the USA, but let's see what happens there.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, pop over to the website to find out more about our subscription. So thanks very much to Michelle, Mark, Michael, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Actually, I'm not sure we will be back next week. I can't remember what the arrangements are. I'll put them in the show notes. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.